Hey everyone, welcome to Daily Tips That May or May Not Help You. My name's Arielle. My co-host is Ned. He's over there. He's over there. And we have our guest tipper of the month on today. He gave us a tip on Wednesday and he will be giving us tips on Wednesday throughout the rest of the month. But today we get to know him a little bit better. His name is Noah Westreich, Rabbi Noah Westreich. We're going to ask a bunch of questions of him now and he's going to give us some tips along the way. Noah, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Arielle. Thanks, Ned. I'm so delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. Noah and I have known each other for more than 10 years at this point. Our first job out of college was together. That's how we know each other. So if we seem overly familiar, that's why. And with that, we're going to teach Ned now everything about Noah and you, Tippendales.
Yeah, Noah, who are you? Give us the download.
Yeah, so my name is Noah Westreich. I am a rabbi living in San Francisco. I live here with my husband, whose name is also Noah. And we have a dog who's 2 years old. He'll be 2 years old on May 14th, actually. So this is his birthday month. I'm originally from Montclair, New Jersey. So East Coast, born and raised. I live in San Francisco now, but I've lived all sorts of places since leaving home at 18. I went to college in Minnesota. The first place I lived after college was Jackson, Mississippi, which is how I met Arielle. After that, I moved to Washington, D.C. for 2 years. And once I was done in D.C., I went off to rabbinical school, which was a 5-year course of study. Year one was in Jerusalem, so that's where I lived for a year. Then I returned to the States to continue my studies in Los Angeles. Then I left L.A. to continue my studies in New York. And I spent 3 years living in New York, living in Brooklyn. And from there, I moved up to Boston, where my husband was finishing his graduate studies. I was already a rabbi at that point. And my first job out of rabbinical school was teaching middle schoolers Jewish studies at a Jewish day school in Boston. From there, I moved to San Francisco, and this is where I've been for the past almost 2 years as a rabbi at Congregation Emmanuel, which is a large Reform congregation here in San Francisco. I'm one of 5 rabbis, 2 cantors. We have 2,000 member families, and we are sort of the destination for Jewish life in San Francisco, among many other wonderful organizations and congregations. But we are a large one, we are an old one, a historical one, and it's a whole lot of fun.
So you leave Montclair, New Jersey at 18, and you go to McAllister College, which is where in Minnesota?
It's in St. Paul, Minnesota, the capital.
What took you that side?
Yeah, you know, I grew up multiple times a year visiting Minnesota for Thanksgiving, for Jewish holidays, or summer vacation, et cetera. And so I, from a young age, just had this affinity, this fondness, this love for the state of Minnesota and all the seasons, I should add. Winter, you know, we're a big winter family. And of course, the summer and spring and the fall, like year round, Minnesota was just such a special place.
Can we have any winter tips, how to stay warm in Minnesota? Do you have any?
Yeah, absolutely. Wear a coat that goes down to your knees. And wear one that is both warm and stylish. I still have my winter down parka that I got during college. And in San Francisco, I wear it probably like, well, now I'm pretty wimpy, but like, you know, if it's like 45 degrees, like, oh, I got to put on my parka. When, of course, in Minnesota, I was walking to class and, you know, negative 80 degrees uphill both ways. I would also say, in addition to having a coat, you know, there's a certain amount of acceptance of the cold. So I remember walking out my front steps and walking to class, and it would be, you know, 7:50 in the morning, negative temps. And I would just walk out and I would take a breath in and I would feel my nose hairs turn to icicles. And I just decided to see that as refreshing, and kind of amazing that I'm so far north in this globe and I happen to be experiencing these temperatures. There's a certain amount of just acceptance and gratitude, frankly, for experiencing any weather.
Do you have a tip for how you change your mindset like that? How do you just decide?
Yeah, you know, it's probably all in retrospect that I'm saying this. I'm sure I hated it at the time. That's not true. when you're in community, you know, you're walking to class with your friends, you're walking to parties with your friends, you know, Saturday night, it's bitter cold. Just exposure therapy. I think that's the answer.
So then you graduate college from Minnesota. Yeah. And it's off to Jackson, Mississippi, where you meet the wonderful Ariel Nissenblatt. Do you have a tip for meeting Ariel Nissenblatt in person?
Do you remember where we met?
I sure do.
Go ahead.
I sure do. Yeah. So we met probably, this is a fellowship program. And so there are like maybe five of us that were part of this fellowship. And the night before the fellowship started, somehow we both end up at the Whole Foods sort of dining area. You know, some Whole Foods have like buffet and then tables. So I was sitting at a table with Ariel and Ariel's mother, Rachel. Hi, Rachel. And another person that worked at the organization. And we just struck a conversation. And my first impression, do you remember my first impression, Ariel?
I don't think it's a good thing, but carry on.
Let's roast her again. I thought something like, wow, this Westchester girly is here with her mom. I'm here all by myself, like making it big in the deep South. 22. Actually, I think I was 21 still.
Yeah, we were both 21 when we started. 21.
Yeah. So I was definitely a little judgy. But then very quickly, we became work wives, I would say.
Noah, can we pivot now towards career and spirituality and things like that?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so for me, it's normal that you're a rabbi. I have a lot of rabbi friends. I know a lot of rabbis. I grew up in the Jewish world. some of them are more religious. Some of them are more secular. Some are somewhere in between. But I think a lot of people might have, you know, they never come across a rabbi who looks like you. But I think that like folks who are not in the Jewish world don't necessarily know that, you know, rabbis aren't just like men with white beards who are always wearing religious garb. They can be anything and anyone and have all sorts of different doctrines that they go by.
It is funny to me the way you described how you assume the stereotypical rabbi is in someone's head, Ariel, because where I grew up in Portland, Maine, I went to a lot of synagogues. I grew up with a bunch of Jewish friends and I would go to, you know, various events, though I myself was raised Episcopalian, but every single rabbi that I remember from a synagogue in Portland was a woman who was like exactly 5'5" with like a very specific haircut. And I remember being like 11 and being like, does she bounce synagogue to synagogue? And my mom was like, that's a different person. And I was like, no, it's not. It's the same. So I do have a very specific image of a rabbi in my head, but it's not Noah.
That's really funny.
It's a 5'5" woman with a very short haircut.
Okay. That's a fair thing to say. I was definitely making a gross generalization. But I'm so gross. But there are definitely people out there who their only interactions with rabbis are like, you know, the people that are depicted in like Holocaust films and things like that.
Or clergy of other faith, by the way. Like there's assumption that if you're a person of God and you're a clergy person, that you're a certain way and you're stale and old-fashioned and judgmental and all of that.
I was raised in an Episcopal diocese with a female bishop and a gay dean.
Wow.
And it wasn't until I was like 16 that I understood that that wasn't normal.
Yeah, that's not at all normal.
So I'm curious about how you got to where you are today, why you decided to become a rabbi, and when you knew that you sort of had this pastoral bone in your body.
Yeah, this is a question I get asked all the time, and I never have the right answer because I'm always sort of going through my mental file folder of all the different things that led me to this point. And there's just so many different things. And so depending on how much time I have and depending on who's asking, I'll say something perhaps very different. But for the Chippendales, I guess the answer that I would give is that it's a lifelong process to become a rabbi. I would still say I'm becoming a rabbi. And, you know, I grew up in a very strongly identified Jewish household in Montclair, New Jersey. And so it meant that Shabbat dinners were really important. It meant that Jewish learning was really important. I was studying two or three times a week. When I was old enough, I was teaching. So the Jewish community, Jewish life was just always central to me. But contrary to the types of Jewish communities that you're describing, mine was very open. Mine was very liberal, very compatible with American values, American society. And so I never felt like there was a tension between my Judaism and my being an American. And the other thing I would say is that being Jewish was the one constant throughout my childhood. I say that to mean there were different friend groups, there were different activities, there were different summer camps and, you know, interests, hobbies, you know. And so I sort of went through childhood trying all sorts of different things. And the one through line was my Judaism and my Jewish community. And so it always felt like a very safe, reliable, foundational place for me. And then when I went off to college, I didn't think at all really about finding Jewish community in college. I didn't choose McAllister. I didn't choose Minnesota for its thriving Jewish community. But of course, shortly after I got there, I realized, hey, you know what? I missed the stability and the constancy of Jewish community. So I sought out other people like me who were Jewish and were looking to build community away from home. And because it was such a small school and small institution, we really had to make things happen ourselves. And so we decided we wanted to have Shabbat dinner. So we had to go to the student org council or whatever and get the money. You know, if we wanted to have Passover Seders or guest speaker, like we had to make it happen for ourselves. And so that's where I sort of got a taste for the first time of building a Jewish community that was working for me and for my peers. And so 4 years of that, and I was starting to think about what I wanted to do after college. I had no idea. You know, I actually entered Alistair thinking I wanted to study international studies and Spanish. That was going to be my double major, and I wanted to be a translator or an interpreter at the UN. And McAllister was the alma mater of one Kofi Annan. And because of that, McAllister flew the UN flag. Kofi Annan was former Secretary General of the United Nations. So the flag was flown. The United Nations flag was flown. The ping pong table in the gym was named after Kofi Annan. The Center for International Studies, I'm not going to remember the actual name of it, was named after Kofi Annan. So international studies was sort of the big thing in McAllister. But shortly after I started, I decided to pivot, and I was really interested in religion, religious studies. And so I ended up majoring in sociology, focusing on religious studies. And that sort of changed the course of my career. So when I was looking for jobs my senior year of college, one of Ariel and my colleagues reached out and actually recruited me to come down to Jackson, Mississippi, and said, this is probably not on your radar, but if you wanted to move to Jackson, Mississippi and work as a Jewish educator traveling around the South, this could be for you. And I was like, that sounds wild. I would never have sought out that opportunity for myself, but they asked me. And so I'm going to say yes, and I'm going to go do this wild thing. When am I ever going to live in Jackson, Mississippi again? I had no idea what was in store for me. But so I moved to Jackson, and there I continued to get sort of Jewish leadership experience traveling to these small, sometimes large Jewish communities. But I was asked to do any number of things based on what the community needed, teaching Hebrew school, leading services, visiting the sick, leading a Shiva minion, et cetera, anything that they needed Jewishly in these sort of underserved Jewish communities by the Jewish institutions that serve the larger Jewish populations, I was asked to do. And so it was really there that I decided, you know what, I think this Jewish professional thing, maybe being a rabbi is something I want. And I moved to DC, had another job at a Jewish organization, this time a synagogue, but I also made sure to try other things. So this is when I worked as a barista at a coffee shop and wanted to, you know, just see, okay, do I really want to do this Jewish thing, or, you know, would I be okay working in another field of coffee perhaps? And it became pretty clear that I wanted to become a rabbi, and it was important to me that I not pigeonhole myself or box myself in to what I thought of as a rabbi, what other people thought of as a rabbi. And so I, every step of the way, I've made sure to bring these parts of myself everywhere I go. And I think that's how I manage being a rabbi, because it can be so insular, but I very much enjoy being a human being in this world too. And so I'm always trying to, and that's how Judaism has been forever, by the way, is that it's always at least attempted to exist sort of in its own world, and then also be really in conversation with the culture and the world around it. I can give a whole history lesson, but I won't. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, I'll stop there.
I have a question for you about, do you have any advice for people who are maybe thinking about a career pivot? Like any interesting framing devices that you put your brain through as you were thinking about, you know, what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I think for one thing, as I mentioned earlier, I am still figuring out. I mean, of course, I'm a relatively new rabbi, but I anticipate that I'll be figuring this out for a lot of time to come. And what I mean by that is, you know, I just try to view every day as new and every challenge as an opportunity. Certainly being a rabbi is a central part of my identity, but it's not the only part of my identity. For example, my husband Noah is a drag queen, and we very much, you know, are part of the gay community in San Francisco. And I don't feel any qualms about going to gay spaces and dancing and, you know, being part of the gay community here. You know, it is challenging to balance sometimes because, you know, on the one hand, I'm a, you know, a figure that's, you know, in the synagogue and, you know, saying very serious things. On the other hand, I'm like going out in the Castro or Soma or whatnot, you know, maybe with my shirt off. And, you know, the truth is I'm scared of that, but at the same time, there's nothing to be afraid of, you know, so I'm able to enjoy different parts of my identity in different parts of San Francisco. So that's one thing, being a gay rabbi, I don't feel at all like boxed in. There's a rabbi that I want to quote here, whose name was Arnold Jacob Wolf. He was a rabbi in Chicago and at Yale, among other places. And he, on his retirement, I believe, he published a compilation of his writings from over his career, and he titled the compilation Unfinished Rabbi, which I thought was so profound because he was retiring after a prolific long career, and he's writing a book called Unfinished Rabbi. The idea that his work is never finished and that his own development is never finished, and that he's always growing and changing, even after retirement. So especially now at the opposite end of retirement, I've just started in this career, just to remember that nothing I do is final, nothing I do is set in stone. And in fact, all our tradition I've ever known is adaptation and change. And that's why it's been so creative and so vital and so compelling for me and so many other people.
When you were deciding to take a rabbinical path, where did you look for guidance on making that decision for yourself? Were you reaching into Jewish communities that were more religious, like other, like rabbis and things like that? Or were you talking to people kind of outside the faith to see how you would find your path in?
Well, I'm very fortunate that I have all kinds of mentor figures in my life. Older rabbis who have sort of shown me the way and who have sat patiently with me and helped me clarify my thinking. And so I would attribute a lot of credit to them. And one rabbi in particular who showed me a totally different way of approaching the Jewish tradition. She's the one who told me that our tradition, our Judaism is traditionally radical. And what she meant by that is that at the core, if you go back to the roots of the Jewish tradition, it is one that is open and desiring and reliant on change and adaptation. So there's a famous story of the year 70 of the Common Era, where the Second Temple of Jerusalem was destroyed, never to be rebuilt. And rather than throw in the towel and say, well, this Judaism gig is up, and rather than converting to other religions or just throwing it out forever, there's a small group of people who became known as rabbis who decided to pick up the pieces of the broken temple, so to speak, take the tradition, bring it to what my teacher jokingly calls ashrams in the wilderness, which we might call synagogues now. And they decided to build a tradition that was away from the Second Temple and was not doing exactly what was done in the temple, but sort of did everything that they did in honor and in memory of the temple while creating and inventing new things. So this teaching really helped me understand that our rabbis, and this is her thinking, not mine, and I agree, the rabbis were sort of the queer people of their time, that they were on the margins, on the fringes. They weren't part of the mainstream culture. They weren't doing things the way that their parents or ancestors did it. They were doing something that was right for themselves in their time. And over time, over 2,000 years, it's become authentic. So much so that some people don't allow for any further development or evolution of it, which is just plain wrong. And as Rabbi Arnold Jacob Wolf put it in an article that he wrote. It's one of my favorite titles of an article.
You're so prepared. I love
so
this.
Prepared. The title of this article is "There is no Judaism but Orthodoxy, and there are no Orthodox Jews." Meaning Whoa. That every time that we try to say, this is how we do things, we are basically creating a sense of orthodoxy. Orthodoxy literally means like the right way to practice or the right way to believe. But there are no Orthodox Jews. That's the second part of that title. Meaning that as people, as human beings, we are primed for change and evolution. And so we can't possibly be Orthodox if we're constantly changing and growing. And so we have to always assume this posture of adaptation, of change, of evolution, and being prepared for it and being resilient. And that's part of what I love about my job, first of all, and second of all, about my tradition and the community that I'm a part of.
How do you approach someone, you know, as a pretty non-religious person myself, like, it's pretty stereotypical to say that, like, people often find religion later, right? Like, people come back to faith or they let it go for a while and they come take a look. How do you, for those who might be out there in the Tippendale world who are feeling like there's a piece they would like to explore in their religious life, how do you recommend they start that process?
It helps when you have friends or community members that maybe are a few steps ahead of you, that you can express your curiosity and sort of be brought in that way. And the other thing I would say is to just show up. Wherever you live, chances are there is a community of faith, you know, Jewish, not Jewish, whatever. And so go to a synagogue event. Usually things are open to the public, or you might have to register, but it's there are all sorts of opportunities. There are not just worship services. There are classes and concerts and all sorts of events that would bring you into, first of all, the community and participate with the community. And, you know, as far as Judaism is concerned, there's no proselytizing or evangelizing. In fact, most of us are not concerned with belief in God or anything like that. We're concerned with community. We're concerned with right behavior, fairness, finding gratitude and beauty in the everyday. And so I would say show up. There's also so many resources that are available online. You know, so many podcasts, so many websites, YouTube. There are ways. I mean, you have to be careful, be judicious about what you're looking for. But there's so many ways for you to sort of get your feet wet when it comes to finding religious and spiritual community. Just start somewhere.
And I think something that you said there that's huge is that a lot of a lot of you and your colleagues are not necessarily concerned with belief in God. Mm-hmm. You don't have to believe in God in order to be part of Judaism, at mm-hmm. least.
Yeah. Yeah. When someone says to me, oh, well, you know, Rabbi, I'm a bad Jew. I don't believe in God. I would respond with the phrase or the question, well, tell me about the God you don't believe in. The idea that, you know, nobody's checking your credentials about what you believe in God or not. We think that this is a conversation that's worth having by saying, is there something out there? Am I connected to my fellow community member by some force? And is there a force or is it just biology? Or all these conversations are really interesting to me. Another sort of catchphrase of the Jewish community is we're about deed and not creed. In other words, you don't mm-hmm. have to believe, you know, any number of things. You just have to act in a way and behave in a way that is acceptable to the community. And usually that's things like, you know, treat people with kindness, with fairness, treat every person as a reflection of the divine image. Don't waste, don't steal. You know, those Ten Commandment things, the original things, most of the behavior is along those lines. And so that's why Jewish people were primarily a people of deed and not creed.
What is your husband's drag name?
Very apropos. It's Miss Gefilte Fish.
Wait, that's so good.
Yeah, Miss Gefilte Fish. So that makes me Mr. Fish.
Noah, let's hard pivot right now. You have many things that make up who you are in life. Of course, you're a rabbi. You have a lot of things to teach when it comes to spirituality. And also, you're just a great question asker and answerer. You come with sources. I love all that. But you also love transportation. You love civics. You love travel. And some of your tips throughout this month are going to be about those things. How did you get into travel? How did you get into these languages? You speak multiple languages. How did all this come about?
Yeah, so I speak English, obviously. That's my native language. And as a kid, I studied Spanish and I studied German, and then eventually I studied Hebrew. So I know four languages. When I was in high school, I had the opportunity to travel to Spain for a summer, summer after sophomore year of high school. And I went and stayed with a family in Barcelona, where the father of the family had stayed with my grandparents as an exchange student in Minnesota, something like 30, 40 years prior to my visit. And we had stayed in touch. And when I was looking for something rewarding and educational, informative to do in the summer, my parents gave me the choice that I could go to camp or I could do, you know, some kind of classes. And I said, I want to go learn more Spanish. And we have these family members, they're basically family members in Barcelona. Let me go stay with them. So I flew over there and I stayed with them for a summer. And that's where I spent time surrounded by this man's kids and all the cousins. And there's all these kids running around speaking Spanish and speaking Catalan for that matter, not knowing that I was or being aware that I was a English speaking American, but not really knowing that that meant that I didn't understand Spanish. Right. And so they would just speak super quickly and include me in all their games. And I learned and picked up Spanish that way. And that was it. I went back several summers in a row to spend time. I ended up finishing the Spanish curriculum in high school. And so I needed to take an elective class and I decided to take German because I wanted to take another language. I started to take German because I had a crush on an exchange student who was from Germany, actually. He taught me, you know, a few basics of German, but I wanted to make my studies more formal. So that's why I studied German for 2 years in high school and then in college, and I spent some time traveling there too. I love the idea of just getting off a plane somewhere completely unknown and unfamiliar. Like, I'm still my same self, and I just flew through the air, and now I'm here, and everyone here is not aware that I'm here. I'm just a visitor, and everyone, I'm just observing how people are going about their life and their days and learning the customs and the, you know, the things you don't learn in German class or Spanish class. You know, people really interact and really talk and order beer and order, you know, find out the directions and everything like that. And so I was just really enchanted by that. Still am to this day. Yeah.
Someone's trying to learn a new language. Yeah. How do you recommend they jump in? As someone trying and failing at learning Spanish.
You are, Ned?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
Cheers.
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 You gotta expose yourself to as much as you can. I mean, the best thing is to be immersed, right? That's what all the language teachers will tell you. And then I would also say, expose yourself to situations where you are, you have no choice but to speak. And you should be okay making mistakes. You know, think about if someone was learning English and they came to you and they had broken English and they were trying to communicate, you would listen and try to pull out from them what they're actually trying to say. And so you have to just trust yourself and speak in your beginner's broken language that you're learning, and trust that people will help you out, and trust that by making those mistakes and by trying those words on and those conjugations on, you'll get better. And also know that you never have to be perfect. There are certain tenses that I just gave up on and I'm not going to try. And so I'm just going to make myself known however I know how to make myself known. And I'm not after perfection.
So kind of along the path that you took us on, despite an insanely circuitous path through places you lived and how you got there, right, geographically, you've seemed to have a pretty clear understanding of who you are and what you like and what you would enjoy to be part of your life from a young age, and it seems to at least have held to now. How do you go searching for new things to integrate into your life? What is it that you do on the hunt for expansion? How do you find a new interest? How do you find, right? Like what, as someone who has been on a pretty, I don't want to say a set path because it's not set, but on a path that seems consistent, how do you experiment in the consistency?
Great question.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've never quite thought about it that way. While it might seem like I'm on a clear path, I definitely don't feel like I'm on that path. And of course, it's only in retrospect that you're like, oh yeah, those things add up. Those
Look at that.
That all makes sense.
Yeah.
When it comes to how to experience novelty and keep exploring, I mean,
ooh, experience novelty is great. I'm stealing that.
He rewrote the question.
All right.
Being in a relationship with someone that on one hand is, you know, we have so much in common, on the other hand is quite different from me. That is certainly one way that I stay fresh when it comes to new experiences. And so I'm married to somebody who, for example, loves backpacking and the outdoors and hosting big social gatherings and events, things that I wouldn't do automatically on my own. He brings parts of me out that ordinarily might stay a little more reserved. So certainly being in a relationship with someone who challenges your sense of sort of constancy and regularity, it can certainly be unsettling too. For anyone in a relationship can attest to the fact that sometimes when you're with someone so different from you on a regular basis, it can feel so encroaching on who you are. And then you have to balance that with the fact that you're better together because you are more expansive and more open So I guess I would say like together we share experiences that are new and exciting. And I would also say that, in my line of work, I encounter all sorts of different types of people. And so I am in a habit of saying yes to things. So people will say, hey, it's crabbing season here in San Francisco and I have my permit. You want to come crabbing with me, Rabbi? I'm like, that's not kosher, but I do want to go. I do want to go sit on the beach and talk to this congregant and
crabber.
Talk to this crabber and learn how to cast a thing, which I never was good at. I never learned. And I said yes to it. And now I can say that I've had the experience of crabbing. That's just one example that comes to mind where try to say yes to things, try to follow my nose when it comes to things that might be exciting or interesting or new or different. Hope I never stop looking and never stop searching because I don't like to be bored. Nobody does.
That's a pretty great answer to that question. Never wanting to be bored is a great motivation, but really just thinking about the small ways the world offers us the ability to learn something new and it really just being a case of you can choose to lean in or lean out is really interesting.
Yeah, and I'll...
It's the rabbi to crabber pipeline for me.
Yeah, crabber. It's a new app.
Yeah, a crab eye.
A crab eye. Yeah. You know.
Oh, that's good.
Had to get there. Well, Noah, thank you so much for joining us on Daily Tips That May or May Not Help You. For May, you are our guest tipper, and you crush it. Love your tips. They're extremely varied, and Tip and Dales can check them out. We have an episode already out from this past Wednesday, and we'll have a few more every Wednesday for the rest of the month. And then we even have a bonus coming up at the end of the month. So lots of Noah Westreich content. Noah, where can people go if they want to learn more about you and or be in touch?
Noah Westreich Media.
I suppose. How can you be in touch? I don't have a.
Do you have a website?
I don't have a website.
We mostly talk to other content creators. We don't talk to a lot of people who are rabbis.
Stop putting that on me.
Sorry, I know. No, Ned hates the phrase content creators. Makers, creators. What do you like?
God is the ultimate
media?
Creator.
Media creator, sure. I'm a person who does stuff.
Yeah, we talk to a lot of people who do stuff and like put stuff out on the internet. And because of that, I'm used to asking where can people find you and follow you and where can they experience your stuff. But I guess for you, it's really like following you IRL at Shul.
Yeah, come to services every Friday night, 6 p.m. We have a program called Late Shabbat, which is specifically for people in their 20s and 30s. It happens at 8:30 p.m. at our synagogue on the second Friday of the month. I'm always there. Yep, Ariel has been. And I guess I do have an Instagram, which I don't update, and they're kind of...
Yes, Southwest.
No, not Yes, Southwest. That was short-lived.
Noah used to have an Instagram where he would take pictures of Southwest planes in the sky. Called Yes, Southwest.
Because I would see the Southwest planes and I was like, Yes, Southwest. And I really thought that the Southwest marketing team would pick it up, but they didn't.
And you could sell it to them eventually.
But I do have an Instagram. It's called at Rabbi Noah W. I have hopes of making it a place where people want to go. For now, you could message me on there, I suppose.
Well, thank you, Noah.
Yeah, so fun to be here.
Ned, thanks for letting me have a rabbi on.
Yeah. The whole point of this show is to meet new people.
You idiot.
Come on. Tippendales, thank you for tuning in. Noah Westreich, thank you for being here. Ariel Nissenblatt, you have to be here, but thanks. And for all the Tippendales out there, we will see you on Monday as we kick off another week of daily tips that may or may not help you.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.